Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Israel's Minister for Strategic Affairs that the military option to strike Iran and kill the recent P5+1 deal is still on the table and is going to remain on the table. Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Relations at Harvard University, who has a recent article at Foreign Policy, Just Say No, Why the United States Can't Kick the Habit of Repeating Failed Campaigns in Its War Against Terror, joins us to discuss whether the prospect that Iran will grow more moderate, responsible, and democratic in the future is a better bet than continuing to ally with Saudi Arabia. Then we will speak with James Jennings, founder and president of Conscious International, a humanitarian aid organization who has worked in the giant Dadaab camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. We will discuss the tensions between the majority Christian community and the growing Somali refugee population in the north of the country, which Al-Shabaab terrorists from Somalia, who recently massacred 148 Christian university students in the northern city of Garissa, were able to infiltrate. Then finally, we will assess the utility of bombing raids by the Kenyan Air Force on Al-Shabaab camps in Somalia and speak with Kiefer Otuso, who is a professor of geography at Bowling Green State University and the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. We will discuss the Kenyan government's denial that its security forces were slow to respond to Thursday's massacre at the university in Garissa. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He is the author of The Origins of Alliances, which received the National Security Book Award, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to be back talking with you.
And Israel's Minister for Strategic Affairs, Yuval Steinitz, who's apparently very close to Prime Minister Netanyahu, says that while Israel prefers a diplomatic solution to what they consider this Iran deal being a bad deal, and which one that they say that they want a better one, without saying how you get a better one, he also said that the military option still exists, is still on the table. So what's your sense of, is this panic coming from Israel, or is this still a serious possibility?
Well, I think calling it panic is a little bit too strong, but I think that there's certainly concern within the Netanyahu government because all of their efforts to derail this diplomatic deal between the United States and Iran have thus far failed. And to make matters worse, at least from Netanyahu's perspective, the reception to the outlines of the deal that were announced last week has been quite positive. Lots of responses from key members of the U.S. national security community, the general reception in U.S. media has been, I think, quite positive. The reception or reaction back in Iran has also been fairly favorable. So, if you were the Netanyahu government and you pulled out all the stops to try and stop this from happening, this has not been good news. And sort of reminding everybody that you might have a military option is, I think, one, effort to sort of reiterate their concerns. I might add, I don't think, in fact, Israel has a credible military option against Iran's nuclear program. So at that, in that sense, it's also a bit of a bluff.
But this is not to say that Israel is not without its supporters here in the United States, particularly in the Republican Congress. And it is, after all, the Republican Congress that holds sway over whether or not this deal is approved with the Corker Amendment that will be coming up for a vote.
Well, it's true. There are some sort of diehard supporters, and then there are, I think, others that I would characterize more as opportunists who have voiced various concerns about the deal, either to elicit campaign contributions or to curry favor with, the Republican base. But I think that so far, I guess I'm optimistic that Congress is not going to be able to derail this. The central problem being that if they do, their fingerprints will be all over the failure. And if they do, what will immediately happen is the international campaign of sanctions, which has helped us get this deal, will immediately start to fall apart. The United States might keep its sanctions in place, but that won't really matter much if everybody else opens up to Iran again. And I think many members of Congress, including members in the Republican Party, you know, might have concerns about the deal, but they don't want to be seen as solely responsible for stopping something which shows every signs of being able to halt Iran's nuclear program pretty much in its tracks.
Well, when I said a moment ago that Israel doesn't have any suggestions about how to make the deal better, that's not correct in as much as there is a list that Yuval Steinitz mentioned to end all research and development activity on advanced centrifuges, a reduction of the number of centrifuges that are operational or that can become operational, the closing of the underground Fordo facility, compliance with revealing past activities, and a commitment to ship its stockpile of enriched uranium out of Iran, and its ability for inspectors charged with verifying the agreement to go anywhere, anytime. Now, my understanding is that a lot of those agreements are actually in the agreements. So,
well, there are aspects dealing with many of those things, although not quite in the terms that he's imposing. But what that list or wish list, you might call it, just ignores the fact is that any international negotiation with other countries involves real bargaining. And no matter how strong you are, no country can usually go in and simply dictate the terms and expect the other side to say, oh, sure, we'll do it. This is a negotiation that's been going on for several years, not just between the United States and Iran, of course. It's got other parties involved. The rest of the so-called P5 plus one are involved in this as well.
Which is the rest of the world powers.
Exactly. And we've gotten an enormous amount of things that we wanted. We wanted to basically create a situation where Iran did not have a nuclear weapon and where it didn't have the ability to get one quickly. And by most calculations, the deal that's been outlined, we still don't know the full extent, and there's still some things that need to be clarified, but the deal that's been outlined would keep Iran at least a year away. And it would also provide for such extensive inspections, very intrusive inspections, so that we would know if they were starting to cheat in any capacity. This is actually quite a good deal, I think, from the American perspective. But the idea that you can simply, let this one fall apart and then go back and negotiate something better, I think, is wrong. The other thing to remember is, of course, the United States did have a policy of insisting on a complete cessation of all Iranian nuclear activities, a complete dismantling of all their enrichment capacity. And we basically refused to negotiate with Iran in a serious way for 7 or 8 years. And in that period, of course, Iran expanded its nuclear infrastructure enormously. They had no centrifuges operating back in 2000, and they had, I guess they have about 18,000 operating now. So the idea that you can simply dictate terms to Iran and expect them to do that is just not an accurate reflection of how diplomacy really works.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. So this wish list that you referred to on the part of the Israelis does sort of sound like it's a little unrealistic, because Israel couldn't have got a better deal with the Iranians. They can't even negotiate with them. The P5 plus one are the world powers. There's no other game in town except to bomb the Iranians, and that would, of course, isolate Israel further. The Europeans would cut ties, which is where Israel's economy needs European trade. The downside for Israel seems extraordinary compared to the possible upside with this deal. And the real issue, as far as I can tell, is that if you looked at the young Iranians pouring into the streets, jubilant at this deal, isn't this really about, in the long term, trying to turn Iran around and allow the majority of Iranians who want to be a part of the world eventually to take over their country from this clique of reactionaries that have been running the place?
Well, I think that's clearly the sort of long-term hope for a number of Iranians and certainly for a number of other world powers. It's also worth remembering that there has not always been the deep suspicion between Iran and Israel. They were actually allies back when the Shah of Iran was in power there. And there were lots of problems with that regime, but there's nothing deep or endemic, it seems to me. And I can imagine circumstances in the years ahead where they do find ways to cooperate with each other, and the suspicion that we've seen in the last few decades allays itself substantially. I think equally important is to remember that what Israel's concern here, and I think this goes for Saudi Arabia, is not so much Iran's nuclear program. There's actually not that much you can do with nuclear weapons. I think it'd be a bad thing if Iran gets them, but it wouldn't be the end of the world or anything. They couldn't use them. They couldn't attack Israel because Israel has nuclear weapons of its own. The real concern, I think, for these countries is sort of Iran getting out of the penalty box that it's been in for the last 20 or 30 years and resuming an active role on the world stage, beginning to trade, getting investment again. As you were saying, young Iranians beginning to travel, getting educated abroad, things like that. Because Iran is potentially a very powerful country, not a great world power, not a superpower, but in terms of regional politics, it has a lot of economic potential, a large population, etc. And I think Israel at present would like to keep Iran as isolated and marginalized as possible. And if this deal goes through, they see that as the first step to Iran once again assuming a more active role in the region. I think that that's very much in America's interest over time for us to have more options. And I think what Obama is betting on is that over time, the clerical regime is going to moderate and modify, and Iran is going to be a respected and reasonably respectable world power. And if that turns out not to be the case, we still have lots of ways of containing its influence.
And if Iran were to get a bomb, and my understanding is that they have a at this point, there's a breakout capacity of perhaps as little as a month. This deal reduces that breakout capacity to a year. But if they were to break out and test a bomb or to, you know, announce that they have a bomb, which is not entirely likely, but let's assume that they test a bomb immediately, the Saudis would buy a bomb from the Pakistanis. I mean, after all, the Saudis are trying to buy the Pakistanis to help them out in Yemen at the moment, along with Egypt. So isn't that a greater problem here, that you'll have a nuclear arms race, even if you say that you can't use these weapons, which I think you're correct, given that Israel has something like 200 thermonuclear warheads that could incinerate all of Iran?
Well, actually, I mean, I think we often overstate the danger of what are sometimes called proliferation chains, you know, country A getting them and getting a bomb, and then B, C, D following suit. You know, so, for example, North Korea tested nuclear weapons some years ago. This did not immediately lead South Korea and Japan and Indonesia and others to go out and follow suit. So it doesn't necessarily mean, even if Iran were to test a nuclear weapon 5 years from now, say, suddenly all of its neighbors would feel compelled to follow suit. There's no certainty involved there. And even if they did, it's not clear they could do anything anything with them. They couldn't blackmail others in any compelling way. I think also this is an argument for why Iran would not, in fact, cross the nuclear threshold, even if they had the capacity. They might be concerned that, yes, if they did test a nuclear weapon, that would lead Saudi Arabia or Turkey or some others to feel like they had to follow suit, and in which case you now have a nuclear Middle East, which in a sense is worse for Iran precisely because Iran has greater conventional military and economic potential, a larger population, more natural resources, etc. If the Middle East stays mostly non-nuclear, except for Israel, over time, Iran's position is likely to be better than if everyone around there has some kind of arsenal of their own. So if I were Iran, I would actually like the capacity to get a bomb at some point if I had to, if I absolutely positively felt I had to at some point down the road. But I wouldn't actually be trying to get one and trying to cross that threshold anytime soon, if ever.
Well, it also, though, when we talked earlier about the young Iranians celebrating this deal, it's obvious that there's a lot of pent-up desire to be back in the real world to trade, tremendous, you know, potential for Iranian business to be unleashed. And it's sort of like the dynamics during the Cold War, is that, you know, you can argue, well, you know, it was the threat of nuclear weapons from the United States that finally brought the Russians to their senses, which is an absurd claim. It's the Cold War and the tit-for-tat military buildup. The more weapons we built on both sides, the less secure both sides became. Many people think it was rock and roll that brought down the Berlin Wall as opposed to the threat of nuclear annihilation. And there may be something to that. And that's what my sense is, that if Iran gets back into the real world, then I don't think these clerics could last forever. And I just don't understand why Israel doesn't get that, because most of the analysts I talk to that know the Middle East and speak the languages, et cetera, they say at the end of the day, we're better off dealing with the Iranians than the Saudis, who have always stabbed us in the back. And, you know, at the end of the day, the Iranians are more rational. And Israel's thrown its lot in with Saudi Arabia, and I just don't get it.
Well, I think from an American point of view, we want to have constructive business-like relationships with as many countries as possible, that there are areas where our interests overlap with certain countries, but there are also areas where we sometimes have differences, and we want to maximize our options. And therefore, we ought to have, you know, maybe not the warmest of friendships with Tehran, but a constructive relationship where we can cooperate in those areas where we might have interests in common, such as trying to resolve the longstanding conflict in Afghanistan. And we'll agree to disagree on those areas where our interests may differ. We don't benefit ourselves at all by being unable to talk on a serious and sustained basis with the Iranian government. And I might add that that makes us more dependent on than other countries in the region. We would have more leverage with everyone in the Middle East if we talked to all different parties. And in a sense, we're encouraging other countries to compete to win America's favor. And the more ties we have with others, doesn't mean giving them everything that they want, just means being willing to negotiate with them and being willing to do business with them where our interests are compatible. That actually strengthens America's overall position.
But if you were to choose between which of the two countries have the greater prospects for democracy and pluralism, surely the Islamic Republic, which does have a form of political Islam, although, you know, it's obviously rigged by the mullahs, but still, it's still way ahead of the Saudi monarchy that give absolutely no rights to its people. And to me, it's just, it's crazy not to recognize, you know, the Iranians may, they've done some really nasty things, and the Quds Force and the IRGC are really bad people. But then you compare that to the Wahhabi influence over Islam that's at the heart of the Islamic State, Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, you name it. Just to me, the choice is real clear who, in the long term, are the better bet.
Yeah. Well, I usually don't like to pin my judgments about, you know, how to deal with other countries solely on the nature of their political systems. I think we often don't understand them well enough, and what works in one country may not work in another, and vice versa. Having said all of that, there's no question that Iran has a more participatory political system. And interestingly enough, the election of the current president, Rouhani, is a perfect example of this, where you know, he basically ran on the basis of a platform saying, look, I will bring, I'll get a deal on this nuclear program and I'll start bringing the country back into the international community. And it was that desire within the Iranian population that led to his election. It's something we obviously want to encourage. I might add, it also surprised a lot of people when it happened, because it seemed like it was, you know, contrary to what many people thought the Iranian political system was capable of. And I think, you know, the Obama administration correctly saw this as an opportunity to pursue an opening that they'd long wanted but really didn't have as long as they were dealing with either Ahmadinejad or with a, you know, fallout from the sort of rigged election of 2009.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Stephen Wall, given that Saudi Arabia now is getting enmeshed in Yemen, which is a real losing proposition if you look back at the history when Nasser went in, he was actually aligned with the Houthis against Saudi Arabia. And now you've got the situation where he's trying to, the Saudis are trying to buy the Egyptians to go in and the Pakistanis to go in and help them. And they obviously have an exaggerated sense of the Houthis' connection to Iran, which most people say is not as deep as the Saudis are claiming. And the young head of the Minister of Defense, the son of the new king, is now going to be tested. And it looks as if the Saudis are going to crash on the rocks there. And equally true, the Iranians are crashing on the rocks in Syria, where they are essentially entirely responsible for keeping Assad in power, since he's running out of Alawite cannon fodder. So it seems to me that if you could get some rationality between the Saudis and the Iranians, there's a deal that could be made there to get them both off the hook.
Maybe, but I think we ought to be sort of wary of or humble about our own capacity to arrange all of these diplomatic stars in precisely the right alignment. I think the larger picture is that much of the Middle East is going through a multidimensional series of conflicts along a whole series of lines, some of them sectarian, some of them ideological, some of them having to do with the sort of fights between different groups within states that are visibly failing. And the United States is not going to be able to play, traffic cop or referee to determine who wins those various outcomes. Our primary interest is to make sure that no hostile powers dominate the entire region. I think that's a remote possibility given all the divisions there. And I think we're, in a sense, going to have to operate with a certain degree of what one might call benevolent neglect. We should not try to sort this one out ourselves, and we probably shouldn't be pushing too hard on any of the individual actors, because I don't think we're particularly good at picking winners in that part of the world.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Pleasure talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, which received the National Security Book Award, and Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And we're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the founder of a humanitarian aid group, Conscious International, who has worked in Somali refugee camps in Kenya.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Jennings, founder and president of Conscious International, a humanitarian aid organization. He worked during the worst of the Somali famine from 2010 to 2011, and he also worked in the giant Dadaab camp for Somalian refugees in Kenya, and previously taught Middle East history at several universities, including the University of Illinois. And you can get more information on Conscious International at consciousinternational.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Jennings.
Thank you, Ian.
And just to follow up on Stephen Walt's analysis of the Iran, the P5 plus one deal with Iran, that clearly Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is either trying to kill or modify, which is highly unlikely. And he's clearly got some support in the Republican Congress here, who will have a say in ending sanctions. The point that I was trying to make was that the prospect that Iran will grow more moderate, responsible, and democratic in the future is surely a better bet than continuing to ally with Saudi Arabia. So to me, that's at the heart of this deal, whether, you know, which side you're going to choose here and which side is more likely over the long term to become more reasonable.
Well, I agree with Professor Walton in one thing, and that is that there is the possibility that there could be some kind of a rapprochement between the Saudis and the Iranians. If not, we're in for a very long a siege of struggle and warfare using proxies. Right now, a proxy war is going on between the two, not just in Yemen, but also in Syria and Iraq.
But it's pretty clear which side, certainly Israel is on. They're supporting the Saudis, and they're against us making a deal with the Iranians. And the point I'm trying to make is that maybe at the end of the day, we're better off with the Iranians. Or both sides are better off with it.
I led a delegation of U.S. academics, several of them, to Tehran most recently about a year ago. And we met with the leader of the nuclear delegation from the foreign ministry for 2.5 hours. And we had a very clear understanding of what their situation is, not technically, which is the province of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Committee, but the Commission, but people who explain the political issues. And so I'm ready to say right now that Iran is far more rational and moderate and willing to engage than they're given credit for in the Western media, and especially by people like Mr. Netanyahu and some of the Republican congressmen. There are two Irans, at least. One is the hardliners, and the other are the moderates. You can deal with the one. The others are difficult, and they have to look over their shoulder against the hardliners, as we do in our country. President Obama certainly is looking over his shoulder at the hardliners in Congress, who can break the deal. But I think it's a shameful day for the United States when a country that's from 11 to 28 miles wide has its leader come to Congress and exercise an actual veto over a major security agreement that we have internationally with another country. And I'm speaking about Mr. Netanyahu.
Well, let's turn to the situation in Somalia near the Kenyan border, where warplanes from the Kenyan Air Force targeted two camps in the Gedo region near the border. From what I can understand, certainly from the BBC, Somalia service said that the attacks wounded three civilians, destroyed livestock and wells in an area where there was no al-Shabaab presence. So are these air raids from Kenya sort of palliatives for the public to make them feel like something's being done, when clearly the Kenyan security services were really absent when they were needed, when these students were massacred?
They certainly failed in preventing or even interdicting the massacre. And that is really an issue that's going to be played out for a long time in Kenyan politics. But no, these military activities against Somalia and the al-Dada, the Shabaab fighters, has been going on for a long time. From 1980, you can date a number of engagements and massacres and attacks all the way up until now, until today. So that's a war that is low level and has been going on for a long time, unfortunately.
So what do you make, though, of calls in Kenya from governors and MPs, particularly from the northeast of Kenya, who've called for the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp, where there are about 500,000 people who have fled the conflicts in Somalia, and you have visited this giant camp. So is there any possibility they would close these camps? I mean, they're making charges that these camps are hotbeds for al-Shabaab recruitment.
It's almost impossible to close those camps. Yes, I was in Dadaab, which is actually a cluster of about five camps with almost, at one time, almost half a million people in them, Hadera, Ifo, Dagaheli, and Dadaab. And it's very pathetic to see the people who walk for maybe 50 miles in the desert, and I ate more dust in that location than anywhere in southern Iraq or Afghanistan or Darfur in Sudan. So it's a very arid place, and the conditions are pretty deplorable. The UN is struggling, UNHCR is struggling in a major way to try to handle that situation. But to move that many people back out of Kenya and into Somalia would be almost an impossibility. And now Dadaab is in the Garissa district where this massacre took place. It's the nearest refugee camp to Garissa. And Garissa is a part of a larger province, the northeastern province in Kenya. And it has such a large percentage of population that are originally Somali. So no, there's no real way that this can be done, that they can close those camps and move those people out, even though in terms of the nationalistic interest, they would like to do that.
And again, I'm speaking with James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine from 2010 to 2011. He worked in the giant Dadaab camp for Somali refugees in Kenya and previously taught Middle East history at several universities, including the University of Illinois. And you can get more information about Conscience International at Conscience International, conscienceinternational.org. So far, it seems that efforts by Kenya's military to deal with al-Shabaab, particularly in Kenya itself, have been spectacularly failed spectacularly. Just last September, they struck what was supposed to be an al-Shabaab camp, but instead killed 36 quarry workers in the northeast Mandera region. So. And after today's strikes, which, according to the BBC, killed a few cattle and a few innocent people, one wonders, is there a military strategy here? I know the U.S. has drones in that neighborhood that apparently targeted so-called high-value targets, but is there a military solution to this porous border and to all of these Somali refugees and Somalis who've or people who have lived in Kenya for a long time and are either citizens or want to be citizens?
And not really. There's no way to win a tit-for-tat war. It's just one attack against the other. I mean, I could give you a whole list from 1980 until now, but most people know about the al-Shabaab fighters attacking in the Westgate Mall in September 2013, killing 67. But before that, 1998, the U.S. Embassy was bombed in Nairobi, of course. And then this most recent one is very shocking when the 148 students were killed, mostly students, and 79 wounded. And then they selected the Christians for execution. So there's a whole narrative that is being promoted by these groups all the way from Daesh or ISIS in Iraq and Syria to those fighters in Libya who marched the Christians out on the beach and executed them one by one to what's been going on in Nigeria, where I was recently, and the killing there by the Boko Haram. So there's a whole narrative that feeds into this. It's a false narrative. And there needs to be a way to deal with the underlying causes. There are also political and economic issues, as in most wars of this type.
But a lot of people I've talked to, specialists on both Middle East politics and religion, when you say there's an underlying reason that ties al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, the so-called Islamic State or Daesh, together, everybody says it's Saudi Arabia, that the Wahhabi ideology that the Saudis promote is almost indistinguishable from all of these terror groups.
Absolutely. And that goes back many, many years. You can actually start in the 8th century of Ibn Hanbal and come up to the 12th century, Ibn Taymiyyah. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab started the Wahhabism in the 18th century, the time of George Washington. He was starting this ideology that said, if you don't agree with me theologically, I will kill you. And even in 1924, the king of Saudi Arabia was, the king of Jordan was complaining that the Saudis were, Wahhabis were attacking and killing his people in southern Jordan. And then you come into the 20th century with the Muslim, Ikhwan Muslimin, Muslim Brotherhood. And then the whole idea of that the jihad has been a neglected duty, which was picked up by Osama bin Laden, and all the rest is history. So, yeah, there's a long story there that fuels that or feeds into the religious hatred that has developed within the Middle East and now expressing itself as sort of the revolt of the third world or developing world, of which many countries are Muslim.
But this gets back to my original question to you, James Jennings, in terms of what I was talking with Stephen Walt about. Is it, you know, if we have a choice between making a deal with Iran and continuing to have a deal with Saudi Arabia, it's pretty clear to me which one is the better deal over the long term, which has the greater potential for moderating and becoming more democratic and more reasonable.
Well, I prefer that the United States engage with all the major players in the Middle East, as distasteful as it may be, and that means Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia, and bring them together in a way that will not exclude anybody, but insist that rational discourse be involved instead of bombs. I don't think that's a very easy task, and it may be idealistic, but I do believe that's the goal. Now, if you want to point fingers at the Sunni monarchies in the Gulf, you can say that they may very well have looked the other way as this cancer, this poison of Daesh, ISIS, began, and were hoping then to move into the and take over after they had failed or collapsed. But that's a very cynical policy. And it has backfired, really, so far. And it is heartening to see that at least on paper and in their testimony, the Sunni monarchies, which includes the King of Jordan, have railed against the excesses of the Sunni ISIS group.
And you were recently in northern Iraq, were you not?
Yes. We were in seven refugee camps holding 80,000 people, and they have all kinds of groups that have come in from Syria and have been forced out of Mosul in Iraq. There are actually 38 refugee camps in northern Iraq, Kurdistan. It's the safest place in the region because the Peshmerga fighters are fairly trustworthy and strong, but they don't have the equipment that they need, and the U.S. Is hesitant to give it to them in very large quantities because the history of that in the Middle East has not turned out to be very well. It ends up in massacres very often. So the Peshmerga are not invincible, but the problems in that area are just unbelievably great, and I think a few people have a perspective on it unless you go there and see the plight of the refugees, which is sad indeed.
But we're, along with the Iraqis and the Iranians, are about to launch an offensive to retake Mosul from Daesh, the so-called self-declared Islamic State, which is probably going to destroy Mosul. And you're dealing with the refugees who are driven out by this murderous group.
Well, the Christians especially say we can never go back to our homes. We love Iraq. We like to live in Mosul. That's where we've been for 2,000 years. We want to stay there. We cannot stay in this environment any longer. It means death. And so they're afraid. And I do not believe that Mosul is going to be retaken soon, because who's going to do it? If the United States doesn't do it, then the Iraqi army is too weak or too afraid or not committed enough. And they don't want to rely on the Shia militias, who are pretty bloodthirsty and have a record of that in Iraq themselves. We don't want Iran to go in there. Who's going to do it? So I think Mosul is a long way off. I hope it isn't. I hope it's just in the next few months, but I wouldn't count on it. And you're right by saying that the Western approach is to demolish it. It's a little bit like the Romans who destroyed countries in order to save them.
Well, just in closing, I know we were ostensibly going to talk about Somalia, but I've taken advantage of your close experience and frequent visits to this part of the world in the Middle East and to these hotspots we're talking about. Are you telling us then that the so-called Islamic State, Daesh, is going to survive for a lot longer, that it's not going to be destroyed soon?
I don't think it'll be destroyed soon, and even if Mosul should be retaken, which I don't expect in the short run, that they will have ways of pressing in other areas. Right now they're in Yarmouk camp, which is a Palestinian camp, in the outskirts of Damascus. I've been there, and really one of the saddest pictures from the Syrian war is from that camp, where it looks like tens of thousands of people are begging for aid, and nobody's there to give it to them. And all the buildings are destroyed. Maybe you've seen that picture.
I have. But, it's an extraordinary picture, yeah.
Syrian war is an aspect of this whole thing, and I think that the extremists are going to be around for a long time. They have a narrative which has some rationale. It appeals to the people who have suffered the American destruction of Iraq and the occupation, and so they don't have any place else to turn. I'm not justifying it. I'm saying that's their rationale.
Well, James Jennings, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Indeed. You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine from 2010 to 2011. He worked in the giant Dadaab camp for Somalian refugees in Kenya and previously taught Middle East history at several universities, including the University of Illinois. You can get more information on Conscience International at conscienceinternational.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether the bombing by the Kenyan Air Force on the Al-Shabaab camps is particularly useful.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them bobo nyanting. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. Yeah. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kefa Otuso, who is the Professor of Geography and the Director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association and the co-author of Population Geography, Problems, Concepts, and Prospects, and the author of Culture and Customs of Tanzania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kefa Otuso.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Kefa, what's your sense then of the utility of these bombing raids that, according to the BBC Somali service, on these so-called Al-Shabaab camps, they killed a few people, some livestock, and blew up some wells, but there were no Al-Shabaab fighters around. So is this a palliative on the part of the Kenyan government to assuage an angry population?
Well, it could be, but at the same time, to the extent that they can demonstrate that, in fact, they were Al-Shabaab camps, then obviously you want to put pressure on the group. But, if they are not actually connected, then you may want to doubt the utility of the attacks. But no government wants to be seen to be weak and unable to respond to some of these attacks.
And in terms of the attack itself, on the killed 148 Christian students who were singled out by the Al-Shabaab, the spokesman for Kenya's leader, Mr. Kenyatta, his spokesman told the BBC that the military was at the scene within minutes of the attack and they'd helped save lives of many students. And this, frankly, flies in the face of footage that I have seen and have been shown around the world, that this attack lasted for 15 hours. And as far as I could tell, the military were there while the guns were being fired and the kids were being killed, and they didn't go in. And we remember similar scenes at the Westgate Mall attack. So what's your sense of how the military responded, given that the government is denying that the military failed to respond swiftly?
I think they must have learned the certain lessons from the Westgate attack, where the military was blamed for not being particularly effective in the response. So they ended up waiting for the Wrecker Squad, which is another paramilitary group that is specifically trained to take care of some of these types of attacks. So from what I'm reading is the military was there to secure the perimeter and make sure that the guys do not escape. But I'm not really sure how far they were from the place where the students were being massacred.
Well, the footage I saw with Kenyan soldiers, literally, you could see the buildings in the background and they could hear the shooting going on.
Yeah.
And it was clearly on the faces of the soldiers. They weren't happy about it, but they didn't appear to be ready to go in. And my understanding is that the ready response force that was formed after the Westgate Moor massacre had to be flown in from Nairobi.
Yeah, and even then it appears that it took several hours for the force to be flown in from Nairobi. I think that's something actually the Kenyan public has been pretty upset about, that the force was assembled as early as 6 in the morning, and it's not clear why it took until mid-afternoon for them to be flown in, then 2 hours of briefing at the site. So there clearly appears to have been a significant breakdown in communication that would have probably, and I emphasize probably, saved more lives.
So is this going to be a political hot potato in Kenya, do you think?
Yeah, it most likely is going to be a potato because, remember, we have gone through a change of, the head of the police force and a change of the interior ministry precisely because of the mishandling of previous terrorist incidents. And so we have two guys that are basically at the top, both the chief of police and the interior minister, that are both new, and this attack has happened under their watch. So I think it's going to call for some heads to roll, but I'm not really sure anything is going to happen because, quite frankly, the attack seemed to have overwhelmed the authorities. The intelligence was actionable, but I'm not really quite sure why it was not acted on.
Well, one of the other incredible aspects of this tragedy was that one of the gunmen is apparently a law student who graduated from Nairobi University in 2013. And his father is a local chief in the very area where the massacre took place.
Yeah, this one has actually been one of those curveballs, because the narrative has been that the people that get involved in these attacks are usually disenfranchised kids that are not connected, not educated. And then you end up with a straight-A student being involved in some of these attacks, which I think is really, really going to challenge our understanding of terrorism globally. And so the question becomes, why would a kid from a reasonably privileged background be involved in these types of attacks? What exactly is there for him to gain? So there's going to be quite a bit of soul-searching for everybody involved.
And again, I'm speaking with Kefa Otiso, who is a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association and co-author of Population Geography, Problems, Concepts and Prospects, and the author of Culture and Customs of Tanzania. And you are from Kenya, are you not, Kefa?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm originally from there.
And so what's your understanding of this country with an 80% Christian majority and a 20% Muslim minority in the north? And you've got these enormous problems with refugees from Somalia. I just spoke with the head of Conscience International, who has been in the giant Dadaab camp, which many Kenyan MPs are now calling to be closed.
Yeah, you know, I'm not quite sure that the terrorists came from this particular camp. Even if you remove the camp, that part of Kenya has a lot of native Somali people. So closing the camp, quite frankly, does not strike me as necessarily going to be an effective way of controlling the problem, unless there's evidence that actually says that these people came from the camp itself. What I do see at this particular point is really, you know, it's a very embarrassing attack. It's frightening, and any government usually wants to be seen to be on top of the situation. And, you know, perhaps there's a connection. I'm not really sure, but I haven't really seen evidence to that effect, particularly connecting to the camp.
And is there anything you think that can be done militarily, given the porous nature of this border between Somalia and Kenya?
No, it's going to be very difficult. Actually, ironically, I've seen suggestions that are beginning to look more like what the U.S. has done on its southern border, building walls. People are suggesting deep trenches that are going to separate the two countries. And I think that would probably give the Kenyan military a better handle on the border if, for example, large sections of it were closed off. Because quite frankly, until Somalia is secure and self-governing and, you know, the government is in control of the territory, it's going to be very, very difficult to control these stray elements. And as you probably know, Al-Shabaab is fighting the Somali government and basically making it more difficult for that government to actually be able to stand on its feet and be able to control its territory. So in the meantime, I guess the best the Kenyan military can do is to isolate the border. And I'm beginning to hear talk of extreme measures like trenches and walls. And hopefully this will end up being a little bit more effective. And only time will tell whether, in fact, they will.
But it does feel that Somalia has either been a failed state or poised to be a failed state for some time.
Yeah.
And it's pretty, I don't know that there's much reason for optimism there, is there?
Yeah, there may not be much optimism, but on the other hand, we have Ethiopia to the north that has also a substantial internal, Somali population and seems to have been remarkably effective in controlling these types of attacks. Remember also that Ethiopia's military has also been in Somalia, but it hasn't really suffered these kinds of incidents. And people are beginning to argue that perhaps the Kenyan military should learn lessons from Ethiopia, which I hear has a much stronger intelligence collection, agency and system than we have in Kenya. But all in all, I think even the very idea that you come to learn that there was actionable intelligence, and unfortunately it was April 1st, and some, even the students themselves, I'm told, thought that it was a joke. So maybe it's a set of unfortunate circumstances, maybe it was intelligence failures, but hopefully they're going to learn from the situation and do better next time. And it's unfortunate that you can almost predict that there's going to be a continued attack as long as these folks are in Somalia. And Somalia continues to be what it is since it has been a failed state since the 1990s.
Well, does this mean that the Nairobi and the eastern coastal regions, which is popular with tourists, because of its Muslim populations, are they prone to attack?
Not necessarily. I think we need to have a nuanced approach to these attacks. And in fact, in some ways, you can say that the government has been effective in pushing the attacks away from the coast and the larger population centers to a degree. It's just that, you know, whenever these types of things happen, obviously nobody can provide a 100% guarantee. But at the same time, you notice that Mombasa was fairly quiet, which is the tourist center. And even all the way to Malindi over the weekend, we haven't really had any attacks in that region. So there may be signs of success in some of these areas. And, like any country, there are spots that are safe and there are also spots that are going to be unsafe, regardless of terrorism or not. So it basically has to be a nuanced understanding of where the terrorist threat is.
Well, of course, in this country, when we have attacks that aren't politically motivated like these attacks, but are usually motivated by somebody that's either mentally ill or has some grudge, but because of ready access to firearms in this country, because of the power of the National Rifle Association, you end up with the large casualties. But the answer from the same people who I hold responsible, which is the National Rifle Association, is they say, well, everybody needs guns, and then it wouldn't happen, which, of course, is insane. And so if you extrapolate that to the situation that just happened in Kenya and to the recent massacre of tourists in Tunisia, you realize, Kefa Otisi, that it's totally easy for somebody, you don't have to be a highly trained terrorist to get an AK-47 and start shooting innocent civilians. You know, that's not exactly, it doesn't require great military skill. But, is there likely to be the same response that we would have here in the United States, you know, with the NRA response, which is, you know, we can't let this happen, so everybody has to be armed?
Well, ironically, in that part of the country, northern Kenya, the local population has actually had access to guns for a while, and initially they were introduced to take control of the situation regarding, you know, cattle rustling. But even there, we are beginning to see that the weapons are being misused. So I'm not really sure that, you know, introducing more weapons is going to be the solution, particularly when you don't really know what some of the weapons are going to be used for. You know, there is even talk sometimes that some of the guns have actually been secured from, you know, government forces, whether they were stolen, you know, or, you know, whichever way they were obtained. So, in short, it's an area that is already awash with weapons, but it doesn't seem to have contributed to more security in that region.
So, Kefa Otuso, what do you think is the answer then, or is there an answer?
I wish I had an easy answer. As you know, a part of the issue here is that we're dealing with ideological, you know, terrorists that don't necessarily take whatever we have to offer. You know, if it was somebody fighting for independence, you give them independence. If it was somebody fighting for money, you give them money. But when somebody is willing to kill themselves for reasons that are beyond this world, it becomes very, very difficult. But we don't throw up our hands, and I think the fact that they were hoping to divide the country, and from what I can see, the country is continuing to be even more united. The Christian population seems to be pulling together more than ever before. I think at the end of the day, surrender is not an option. Obviously, there's a need to continue investing in that region. There is a need to continue investing in the peace process in Somalia. And in the end, as the Somali government becomes you know, stronger and stronger, you know, I think that this problem will continue to decline. But it's not going to be tomorrow for sure from the look of things.
And it's pretty clear that the Muslim population in Garissa came out in droves demonstrating against al-Shabaab.
Yeah, because remember that in 2010, Kenya passed a devolved constitution that actually has provided a lot of power to local units that was formerly lacking, and was actually one of the points of grievance about the Kenyan state. That,
sure.
For example, people in that part of the country did not even feel to be members of Kenya. Now here you have a local Muslim governor. They can finally begin to have a university. This is actually a very new university that was introduced recently, partly to respond to some of the historical injustices and, you know, being left behind the development process. So for the first time, people are beginning to see something positive coming out of government, coming out of Nairobi. And then you have people that are basically spoiling even for the local Muslim population. So I do see hope in that as well, that, right. For example, some local Muslim groups have actually come out very strongly, and they're even using Islam itself to denounce these attacks. There is a reason to be hopeful.
Sure. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I do appreciate you joining us, Kefa Otuso.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kefa Otuso, who is a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.